Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 10, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got three segments up for tonight. First, a return engagement with Bill Fletcher of United for Peace and Justice about the tasks for the anti-war movement after those worldwide television images of Saddam's statue falling yesterday. I gather the news was a little less liberatory today, but how will we handle this apparent success by the Bush administration? And then about 20 minutes after the hour, we'll speak with Gilberto Buenaño, who was recently in the Venezuelan government, now a professor of planning, about the view from Venezuela, how the Iraq war looks there, and where they feel like they're next on the list of target countries. And then finally, we'll speak with the former investment banker, turned journalist Nomi Prins, about the contracting bonanza in Iraq, who's going to make what, doing what, and also a look at the Defense Policy Board and their business and political connections. And before we start, an announcement. A book party / forum, It's a Free Country, next Wednesday, April 16, 7:30 p.m. at the Brecht Forum. Personal Freedom in America after September 11. A bunch of contributors to a book about that, published by Akashic Books. That will be the Brecht Forum, 7:30 next Wednesday. Mark your calendars. That's the Brecht Forum is 122 West 27th Street in New York. And again, next Wednesday, 7:30 p.m., among the speakers, Danny Goldberg, the record executive, Donna Lieberman of the Civil Liberties Union, Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and others to be announced and introduced by my beloved Liza Featherstone. So again, next Wednesday, April 16, 7:30 p.m., Brecht Forum at 122 West 27th Street. And what is next for the peace movement after all those images of Iraqis, or some Iraqis, as the Financial Times put it today, dozens of Iraqis surrounded the statue that was toppled and hundreds lined the streets. So, you know, there was not exactly Berlin in 1989. But anyway, that's the way it's being spun. And what does it mean for the peace movement? Interview I recorded earlier today with Bill Fletcher of the Trans-Africa Forum and also one of the principal organizers of United for Peace and Justice. Bill Fletcher.
Welcome to WBAI, Bill Fletcher. We all saw the statue of Saddam Hussein falling yesterday, and crowds of Iraqis cheering in the streets. This, I gather you anticipated this, but what does an anti-war movement do from here, now that it looks like Iraqis seem to be welcoming their American visitors?
Well, Doug, first of all, thanks for inviting me on again. I think we have to be very careful about how we evaluate what happened yesterday. You know, if people coming out to cheer was a criteria for justice, then Hitler's Anschluss of Austria would have been at the top of the list. So I think we have to be very careful in evaluating the cheering. That being said, it was clear to most of us in the anti-war movement that this was a very unpopular regime. In fact, you know, we had been saying this for years prior to the Bush administration, or the Clintons, or whoever, that this was a very unpopular, it was a very dictatorial and tyrannical regime. So the fact that it collapsed in the way it has, or it appears to have, comes as no surprise. I think that this does raise challenges, though, for the anti-war movement. First of all, I think it's too early to tell whether or not military resistance at some level has ended or effectively ended. There's a number of possibilities, and some that I was thinking about on the way to work today, that include that, particularly if Saddam Hussein is dead, it's very conceivable to me that a new leadership could emerge within what's left of the Ba'athist Party and create some sort of resistance movement that could make things really uncomfortable for a lot of people for a long time to come. A second possibility, which is very ominous, is that right-wing clerical forces could decide at this point to begin a sort of Islamic resistance movement against the occupiers, which could really turn things upside down. So I think that there's all sorts of possibilities that we're facing at this juncture. Our movement, I would argue, needs to forcefully argue or forcefully advance the proposition of no occupation, withdrawal of U.S. troops immediately, and we need to connect this issue of no occupation with the issue of the occupation of Palestinian territories. I think that that's right there on the agenda for us.
Well, no, but having destroyed the existing state and party structure, withdrawing U.S. troops now would leave a complete vacuum, and looting and chaos would ensue, wouldn't it?
Not if the United Nations gets involved. I mean, I think that at this point, given what the Anglo-American invasion has wrought, I think that it's critical that the United Nations is involved in peacekeeping and in reconstruction efforts, and not this euphemistic term that Blair and Bush have used about having a vital role. The United Nations needs to be central in this process.
I don't know if Bill O'Reilly has called you to invite you on his show yet, but
yet.
Whether he or Christopher Hitchens, I'm sure, will be gloating and saying, "I told you so." What's your reaction to that kind of gloating?
No, they told us nothing. I think we have to be very clear, Doug. This war, regardless of how it ended, was an illegal war. That's the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue is not whether the U.S. won or how quickly it won. Every one of us, I mean, unless you were living in some opium dream, you knew that the United States was going to win. The strongest military force on this planet defeated a small country whose military forces are weaker than they were in 1991. I mean, surprise, surprise. There's nothing new under the sun there. So what did they tell us? They didn't tell us anything. The issue is whether or not a country, in this case, the United States, has the right to intervene in the internal affairs of a sovereign nation when there is no immediate threat to that country, this being the United States. That's the issue. There's no other issue. I mean, the matter of human rights abuses in Iraq, the matter of the Saddam Hussein regime being a tyrannical regime, are relevant from the standpoint of those are the challenges that the Iraqi people had, and they certainly needed various forms of support from outside. What they didn't need was an Anglo-American invasion.
Well, I've talked to many good-hearted liberals in the last day or two who have been saying, you might have these legalistic objections or reservations about the Bush regime in general, but, as R.W. Apple said, you can't argue with success. We accomplished this mission of liberation, and all you skeptics have been proven badly wrong. And now Iraq can flower. I mean, what do you say to that kind of...
Again, it goes back to proven wrong about what? Proven wrong about international law? I mean, I think the thing is, it's what the political right has attempted to do time and again is to say that we in the anti-war movement were supporting Saddam Hussein, and that's ludicrous. We were the ones that were saying in the 1980s that Saddam Hussein was a demon, that Saddam Hussein was engaging in war crimes against the Iranians, that he was engaging in genocide against Kurds. We were saying that at a point when Saddam Hussein was an ally of the political right in the United States. So this whole reconstruction of history is completely ludicrous. The issue is whether or not the United States has the right to go into other countries and reconstruct those countries in a way that is favorable to the Bush administration. I think no, and forcefully no. I think that we have to insist on taking a stand. I was looking through over the Internet this morning, and you're hearing more and more of threats to Syria, threats to Iran. I mean, these guys have learned all of the wrong lessons out of this situation, and even though they are saying, people like Wolfowitz and others, well, we're not exactly talking about military intervention. Well, I mean, that's sort of the way this whole thing began with Iraq. It began as, Oh, no, no, we're not talking about going in. We're talking about Saddam must disarm. So, I mean, we're dealing with Humpty Dumpty talk. Words mean what they want us to want them to mean, nothing more or less, rather than dealing with the truth.
Well, what next now? I mean, it looks like these guys are almost certainly been emboldened by their apparent success and will certainly have a long list of countries they want to take on. So how does the peace movement regroup and develop strategy for the next battles ahead?
The short answer is that that's exactly the task that is on our table right now, to figure that question out. The thoughts that I have on this, however, are along these lines. It seems to me that the anti-war movement needs to be more than a peace movement. It really needs to be a movement that is raising more and more the central question of imperialism and the impact of these adventures on the people of the world and the people of the United States. We need to be drawing the connections between $75 billion for this war and theoretical rebuilding of Iraq and the budget deficits of states here in the United States. I think we have to talk about, again and again, does this bring us any closer to any notion of security? And it doesn't. This completely destabilized the world. I was reading an editorial this morning where someone was saying, well, you know, all these doomsayers were talking about this would destabilize the Middle East. One of the problems in the United States is that we have a very short time span, when we're looking at events. You know, the fact that Saudi Arabia, the government, was not overthrown in the last 3 weeks is meaningless. What we have to be looking at is long-term tendencies. That's the question. This clearly destabilized the Middle East. The question of how it's going to play out, I would contend, remains an open question. So I think that we have to be holding this before the people.
Yeah, I think we're governed by people with the mentality of futurist traders. Speaking with Bill Fletcher of the Trans-Africa Forum and United for Peace and Justice, how do you read the mood of Americans? Are they whooping in triumph, or how moved are they? What's your reading of their emotions and psychology right now?
Can't tell just yet. As best I can tell at this point, it's more relief, which I think is premature. I do think, though, that right-wing pundits and the establishment media is really beating this triumphalist drum that is very, very dangerous. You know, one of the things that has happened is that people have this sense of clean wars, in part because of the way that the wars are broadcast on television, and in part because of the limited U.S. casualties. And what few people look at, unless they listen to Pacifica, is the human cost to the people of Iraq and the impact that this has long-term to that country and to its population. And so I think, unfortunately, many people in the United States, the way that they judge this is, well, you know, this could have been a lot worse. There could have been more U.S. soldiers killed. That's the criteria. As opposed to, look at what happened. We violated international law. Thousands of civilians were killed, you know, plus, you know, countless numbers of Iraqi troops. For what? And they have, as of yet, been unable to find weapons of mass destruction. And no case was ever offered for any immediate threat to the United States. These things are being clouded by this notion that we came there, we toppled this dictatorial regime, and the people love us. And I think it's up to us in the anti-war movement to debunk those notions.
Let's change gears a little dramatically. I wanted to bring this up with you last week, but we ran out of time. The anti-war movement, or the peace movement, whatever you want to call it, has been criticized, like, you know, the so-called global justice movement, for being very white. Why do you think there aren't as many people of color in the movement as one would hope?
Well, I think it depends on how you define the movement. That there are many established people peace organizations that are predominantly white is a historical phenomenon that goes back decades. And there's really no surprise there. I think what has struck me about this anti-war movement is something different. One is that there has been a fight in most of the coalitions to ensure that people of color are well represented in the leadership. And I think that this has been a very significant fight because it's not simply about diversity. It's about strategy. It's about who's at the table. So that I found very exciting. And even in the protests, I have thought that, I mean, look, this is a majority white country. I think that there has been good attendance of people of color. Now, that said, I think that there are some challenges that really face us, and they don't fall simply to the anti-war movement, but they fall also to organizers of color. First of all, it's sort of like that old saying goes, when you're up to your rear end in alligators, it's hard to remember you're there to drain the swamp. For many of us of color, there are a myriad of issues that we're facing that more often than not seem more imminent at the danger level than foreign policy issues. This is a major challenge that we at Trans-Africa Forum find ourselves up against. So it's not simply the anti-war movement. And part of the problem is that there is not the connection that's being drawn by enough organizers and leaders of color between domestic and foreign issues. You know, we don't have enough Du Boises, people who saw no contradiction between building a Pan-Africanist movement against imperialism and colonialism, as well as taking up a domestic fight against white supremacy. There are not enough people that are thinking in those terms. And I think part of what we have to do is to replicate the Du Boises and the Robesons. That's a very immediate task. I think within the white anti-war movement, there's obviously racism, but there's a certain kind of racism which I think is very pernicious, and that's what I'd call the comfort zone type, where activists certainly at a level of logic, and maybe even morality, believe that there need to be more people of color involved in leadership and participation. But there's a comfort zone. They are themselves comfortable in a certain way or with a certain way of operating. And when you start introducing people who have hitherto been outsiders, it necessitates a change in operations, a change in culture. This is uncomfortable. It's much easier to set the table and invite somebody to dinner than to consult with them in advance and to choose the menu. And I think that this is a big challenge that the anti-war movement faces.
Could you give an example of what you mean by this kind of clash of cultures?
Outreach. Who should be speakers at major events. Whether or not there is attention to bringing in organizations that may not be largely foreign policy oriented, but are themselves significant constituencies. This kind of decision or discussion is something that is often lacking in anti-war circles. Or what happens, and this is the more dangerous side, is that a meeting is called that ends up being largely or exclusively white. A basic agenda, maybe a structure is established. And then at that point, people look around and say, oops, what's missing? You know, we need to have more people of color here. And then there's an outreach component. But again, after everything is set, I mean, this is something that I remember going back to 1970 when I was in high school and we organized a walkout around the Kent State murders, that it was at my high school, it was black folks that put out the call, but ultimately it turned into a white demonstration by the people that congealed, that organized, called the meetings, who they invited, how the agenda was set. and then ultimately the people that originated the call ended up being displaced.
And finally, I mean, do you think this, you said, talked earlier of drawing linkages between imperialism and domestic crises.
Right.
Do you think that, you know, this is one strategy for diversifying the movement?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing is, Doug, that we're in this strange period. For years, you know, we on the left were chastised for using terms like imperialism. But now the ruling class uses it very openly. And often with pride, that we now have a U.S. empire, and we always have, but they're saying it with pride, and they're saying that, you know, we have to put on a happy face to this empire. I think that we in the anti-war movement, and definitely those of us on the left, can now very openly talk about what is imperialism. Imperialism is not simply a bad foreign policy. It's also about who controls corporations here. It's about the fact that we have an economy that is in the toilets. I think that there's ways that we can raise this with regular people, but we have to approach it on the basis of a dialogue with people at the base. So I'm actually very confident that we can do that. This is a challenge for the anti-war movement. We have to take it up.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Bill Fletcher, and we'll certainly be in touch in the future.
Thanks very much.
And that was Bill Fletcher, who is with the Trans-Africa Forum and also one of the principal organizers with United for Peace and Justice about the tasks facing the peace movement after as the war winds down, although it's certainly not over. And we'll be back in just a minute, and hopefully we'll have a Venezuela on the line if all goes well. Let's listen to this old classic from Mission of Burma. That ancient song now, 20-some years old, from Mission of Burma. That's when I reach for my revolver. And God, sometimes I feel like that, don't you? And now we're joined on the line by Gilberto Buenaño, who is, apologies for my terrible Spanish. I feel guilty about this, considering the city and hemisphere I live in, but I just have to live with many burdens of guilt, and that's just another one of them. But Gilberto is a professor at the Center for Environmental Studies of the Central University of Venezuela, who's doing research in environmental planning and sustainable development, and was in the Venezuelan government, right, Gilberto?
Yes, sure. I was working as a vice minister of planning and regional development also for the Venezuelan government.
Now you've
until last year, yeah.
You've gone off to the more comfortable life as a professor now, right?
Sure.
So,
continuing.
What does it feel like watching the war in Iraq from Venezuela? Do you guys feel like this is a picture of your future?
Sure, of course. We are very concerned about what is going on right now in Iraq and with what is going on right now, you know, around the world concerning what the several reactions of against what some countries want to do with their destiny. Venezuela, for instance, is right now in the celebration or commemoration of the one-year military coup that occurred 1 year ago, as you might remember. And we suffer ourselves cases of intervention from foreign countries. And everything was because we want to do to run our own destiny. And something like that is going on right now in Iraq, and we are very concerned because what is going on right now in the world is that every time everyone is wants to have their own destiny, then are they going to have an intervention from the foreign countries that don't like what they are doing just because they don't like it? We are really concerned about that.
But, of course, the Bush administration talks a lot about bringing democracy to Iraq, but the government of Venezuela was democratically elected, and initially the U.S. supported the coup, although they seem to at least publicly have changed their mind by the next day. What signs are you seeing from U.S. policy now in Venezuela? Are they does it look like they're plotting against you? Do you see any visible signs of that?
Yeah, it's a very hot issue. You know, we have to deal with very, very carefully with that matters, because we used to make a strong difference between governments and people. When we have criticism against the United States, we are not talking about the American people. Something that we would like that to be understood. We are criticizing the policies of the American government. We know that the legitimacy of this government, the Bush government, is in question. That's the first issue. The government of Venezuela is not only more democratic than the government of the United States, but also has more support from the people. More than 60% is a landslide election held about four times in Venezuela, was won by Chavez, by President Chavez. So, you know, talking about legitimacy, we have a lot of lessons to teach about that. I don't know if other countries have this legitimacy. Not only that, but after 4 years of government, the support from the population is still strong and even higher. As a matter of fact, next Sunday we will have a huge concentration in Caracas, celebrating the 1 year the returning of Chavez, who was reinstated by his people by the Venezuelan people, as the war already know what happened. So even though some governments acting in the name of democracy, of freedom, try to teach lessons to the rest of the world, I would advise is to first instate democracy in their country, inside those countries. The world right now is very concerned about what is going on in the United States. The freedom of speech is in question too. It's not what it is to be the main freedom in that country. It is clear that news that are not flowing freely in the country, and as we know right now, all around the country, huge demonstrations against the American government are being held in the United States, and we are now understanding that freedom and democracy is something that must be practiced. It's not only something to be talked about and trying to be taught to other countries.
And since the half hour is approaching, I should say this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM on the radio dial and WBAI.org on the web. And I'm speaking with Gilberto Buenaño, who is a former member of the Ministry of Planning of the government of Venezuela and now a professor at the Center for Environmental Studies at the Central University of Venezuela. Now, in recent months, though, you've experienced strikes at the state oil company, and the economy in Venezuela was thrown for a pretty severe loop. What's happening there? The strike. What's the status of the strike, and how's the economy doing?
Sure. We would like to call that sabotage rather than a strike. And a strike is when the workers of the company, go against the direction of the head of the company. That wasn't what happened in this case. On the on the contrary, what happened is that the head of the company, the executives of the company, decided to sabotage and to avoid the workers to come to the factories to work in the oil companies in Venezuela, which is owned by the state, by the government. And as a result of that, the government and the country as a whole suffer very important damages. For instance, we couldn't produce gasoline, we couldn't produce gas for domestic use. A lot of people suffer the consequences of that. It's something like what is going on in Iraq. You know, it's trying to destroy the house in order to free that from rats or from some whatever malignant things can be over there. After you kill or you destroy the house, you will be with no house at all, and everybody will suffer. That logic of was applied to Venezuela by a small group of opposition, but with a very strong support from very wealthy people, not only in Venezuela, but also in other countries. This is the second time that this opposition group tries to overthrow the government of President Chavez. And I hope the lesson has been learned. We are open to all kind of democratic procedures to change governments. In our constitution, for the very first time, there is a referendum that it can be applied at the middle of the government period to decide if the president will continue as a president or not. The population, the Venezuelan population, have that tool, that instrument to decide democratically if they want or not. But you cannot change the government wherever you feel like you don't like it or you don't want it. You must follow the constitution and the rules, and that's what we have in Venezuela, and the population in Venezuela have defended so very, very, very well. As I told you, it's the second time. First was when the military tried to overthrow the government, and the population brought back Chavez to the president. And the second time is when they tried to damage heavily this oil industry in Venezuela, and the population reacted and helped to repair and bring it back to business this industry. And as a matter of fact, this is a worldwide record that we have achieved, because in only 2 months we are back into business as normally in the oil industry, at least.
So of course, oil production is back to normal levels?
Yes, of course. Yeah, we are exporting. We produce around 3 million barrels per day, and we are already doing so. We also had a problem with the production of gasoline. You know, with environmental regulations that are very heavy in Venezuela, we don't produce leaded free gasoline. So we have to. It is a technology that is a little bit more complicated than producing regular gasoline, and so on and so forth. But it has been well recognized around the world. But in only 2 months, the oil industry in Venezuela went back to business as usual, normally. And, you know, it's quite an achievement, but that's not easy if we didn't have the support of the whole population. You know, people who had to drive, big trucks to bring, to load the materials and to guard pipelines because, you know, they were being attacked by some people, or terrorists that wanted to damage these pipelines. So, you know, it's the population, the whole people, trying to preserve what belongs to us, basically, because in Venezuela, the oil industry belongs to the people of Venezuela.
Let me change the subject a little bit. You're do you teach ecological economics and you work on sustainable development plans.
That is correct, yes.
Oil, of course, you know, oil is the centerpiece of the Venezuelan economy. Oil is almost the enemy of decent ecology and sustainability.
Yes.
Are you thinking about ways to diversify Venezuela away from oil?
Yeah, we are very concerned, and actually our policy has been to reduce oil production, something that is not very well understood in the world, especially in the developed world. We advise not to use too much oil. And as a matter of fact, our proposal to OPEC was to reduce the oil production, to maintain a fair price for the oil, but to reduce to the production so we don't contaminate that much. On the contrary, the war on Iraq, what it's trying to do is to inundate the whole world with oil. That will produce an ecological imbalance in the world. We cannot afford continue to produce contamination and pollution with oil. So our policy has been in a proposal that was very successful in OPEC was to reduce the oil production. That's the first step. But the second step is to substitute oil for other sources of energy. And as a matter of fact, in Venezuela, more than 70% of electric energy comes from hydropower. Being an oil country, that seems to be a contradiction, but no, we are very well aware that we should not be spending the oil to produce electric energy. We should be very concerned about spending oil. We have to think in future generation, and that's what sustainable development is all about. Is to think in future generation that the future generation should have at least as much as we have opportunities to for the development or for their life conditions. And the third step, not only to substitute for new sources of energy, but also to use oil in other uses that where it is more productive or has a better possibilities. As a matter of fact, at this moment, not only in Venezuela but in other research institutions on the world are thinking in oil for food intake because the amount of calories and energy that has the oil is could be used in a human diet. However, we have not already developed the whole technology to put that into at the service of humanity. But can you imagine that instead of burning oil just for the fun of people who want to travel for, you know, whatever reason, we could be using that in a more productive way, like, for instance, feeding people that are in the world or at this moment are dying of starvation. You know, this is the kind of the line of research that we in Venezuela and the policy that we are putting into practice. However, of course, there are a lot of people who don't care about the future generations or about contamination or pollution. And you know the war, actually, the war is an act of it's an insane act where you use the natural resources to kill natural resources. And non-renewable natural resources being converted into bombs and burning people and destroying buildings and agricultural fields. You know, that's insane. That's a this is precisely the way in which we should not be using oil.
Well, I fear the United States is run by a gang of madmen, so insane behavior is par for the course. Well, we're out of time, but thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Gilberto.
We're all invited. We have the celebration in Venezuela. This is the first year of this demonstration, democratic demonstration, and we hope the world will follow us in this building our own path of development.
Well, good luck with it all. Thanks for joining us, Gilberto Buenaño, who is a professor at the Center for Environmental Studies at the Central University of Venezuela. And we'll be back to speak with Nomi Prins right after this musical break. We'll be right back. And that, of course, was the classic Pink Floyd, Money. And we're going to talk about money and war, specifically the contracting bonanza that seems to be awaiting well-positioned U.S. firms. And we're now joined in the studio by Naomi Prinz, former investment banker turned journalist, who interviewed some time ago talking about the telecommunications disaster. And now she's been researching who's lining up to make some money off the reconstruction of Iraq. Welcome to the studio, Naomi.
Thanks, Doug.
I guess a lot of people have heard about that Halliburton contract, but there's a lot more involved. First of all, the Halliburton thing, is it as smelly as it looks on first glance?
Halliburton has been smelly since, a lot before the last war, where they were a very leading contractor at the time to help rebuild after the Gulf War. And since then, they've certainly been in the running to continue to do that, aside from having had the benefit of having had Vice President Dick Cheney running them as their CEO from 1995 to 2000, sort of in between wars.
And he didn't do a real bang-up job when he was there, did he?
No, actually, he leaves a legacy of SEC investigations, a subsidiary that is going to look at bankruptcy as an alternative to, basically as an alternative to staying alive. And he also took over a company that has 320,000 asbestos class action suits following it around. So he didn't do a great job as the CEO of Halliburton. However, he's done a very good job of making sure that Halliburton stays in the running for continued contracts out of the current war with Iraq.
Now, the company, the subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, that got a contract to put out some oil fires, now says they're one of the fires they may go under. Is that the...
Well, one of the things about Kellogg Brown and Root, KBR, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton, they received a contract before the war officially began in the beginning of March, and that contract was not actually put out to bid. They just sort of got it in secret, the reason being that it was a security violation, according to the Army, to actually tell anyone that they had been given that contract through Halliburton. There have not been as many oil wells, oil disasters to put out as there were in the last war, in which there were about 700 oil fires to be put out, which actually made a lot of money for some of the companies here in the U.S. This time there's only been a few. So the problem for KBR and other subsidiaries and subcontractors is that there isn't actually enough oil fires to put out, and that really hurts them on the bottom line.
But, of course, the U.S. having destroyed a good bit of Iraq, not just in recent weeks, but over the last 10, 12 years, what does it look like? I mean, what does the contracting field look like? What are the likely sectors and who are the likely beneficiaries?
One of the things that's been completely decimated, and I'll get to oil in a second, is the communications infrastructure in Iraq. It was decimated in the beginning, the last war, and at the time, actually, Saudi Arabia had given a $4.5 billion contract to Lucent to help build some infrastructure for them after the war. Since then, most of the communications networks have been either bombed when other companies who were not U.S. companies were involved in working for Iraq to build them up. And right now, there's anywhere between $1 to $1.5 billion in contracts probably up for grabs in terms of landline and mobile phones. And up to about $8 billion in the region in general for communications technology. As a matter of fact, one of the representatives out in South California, Daryl Issa, suggested to Rumsfeld that Qualcomm, a communications company here in the U.S., undertake the cell phone mobile development in Iraq instead of that going to, for example, a French firm or a Russian firm or a Chinese firm.
Yeah, telecommunications is one of the areas in which European firms are actually quite competitive, but they're, going to be frozen out of the bidding?
The biggest communications firm has actually been French, Alcatel. They've been working with Iraq over the last decade for contracts for their communications network, and they've been basically shafted by the U.S., as have many corporations and will, as many corporations will be who are not U.S. domiciled. Another company was actually Huawei, which was a Chinese technology and communications company that was working on infrastructure in Iraq. The U.S. decided in February of 01 and again in June of 01 to bomb Huawei's networks because they thought that they were going to be used for Iraq military purposes. It's a nice way of keeping other companies out of the bidding for communication growth and infrastructure in Iraq.
That gives a new meaning to the term military Keynesianism, too. you bomb out the competitor's infrastructure, and you make sure that one of your guys gets the contract for rebuilding it. Now, I guess the theory is that they're supposed to pay for all this out of oil revenues, but the Iraqi oil industry is in fairly dismal shape. So I would imagine that's pretty rich ground for contracting, too. What's that look like?
Well, the estimates on rebuilding, and in particular digging for new oil in Iraq, have gone anywhere from $10 billion per year for the next 10 years to $5 billion over the next few years and just some random larger number than that afterwards. So the numbers that are put on the oil infrastructure rebuilding and digging have been completely in the double to triple digits in billions. And there's a number of companies who are up for any type and any component of that business. Halliburton is certainly one that's looking for contracts there. And Halliburton will actually make money no matter who and which company digs for oil, because they basically can build the parts that are necessary to extract oil from the ground. So whoever wins contracts, Halliburton wins, even if they're not in the primary running. But other companies like Chevron Texaco, for example, last week said that they would be, quote, willing to build and work on the oil reserves out in Iraq to help them out. There is a component of something called the Future for Iraq Committee that's part of the State Department. It was created in October 2002, well before the official start of this war. And they've actually been discussing, and they've had their fourth meeting last week, what should be done with oil interests in Iraq. And they have decided that it would be best to have an international control, Reed U.S., of the oil industry going forward. And people in the running for the position of running oil policy include the former president of Shell in the U.S.
Well, that's very interesting, because the president and his minions have been telling us for weeks and now that Iraqi oil belongs to the Iraqi people, but that seems to be their concept of that seems to be not a little loose. So it looks like British and American companies are going to get all the get their hands on it.
Yeah, the Iraqi oil for the Iraqi people is a mantra that actually many of these corporations, including Chevron Texaco, have said in terms of their spokespeople. But in reality, the Iraqi people are not the ones who are running the policy committees to decide how to dole up the oil, as it were.
I'm speaking with Naomi Prinz, who's a former investment banker turned journalist who has been investigating the contracting bonanza in post-war Iraq, although it's a little premature to speak of post-war Iraq, I guess. You've also been looking at the Defense Policy Advisory, a Defense Policy Board Advisory Committee, which is quite a gang of interesting characters. Looking down this list, I see Nobel Prize-winning right-wing economist Gary Becker, former Defense Secretary Harold Brown, who was known as Bomber Brown during the Vietnam era for because he was picking bombing targets, was Secretary of the Air Force. Former House Speaker Tom Foley, another former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Henry Kissinger, the ubiquitous, ghoulish, evil Henry Kissinger, J. Danforth Quayle, our former Vice President. But aside from these celebrities, oh, and Ruth Wedgwood, who is a something of a human rights lawyer, but evidently she's also consulting on on military policy. But what is the Defense Policy Board? And you know, aside from those celebrities, who populates it?
The Defense Policy Board is designed to look at U.S. policy, to advise on U.S. policy. It is run by, or effectively, the people are elected by Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld. And it is a group of interesting characters, certainly the ones that you mentioned. It's important to note that of the ones you haven't mentioned, 9 of the 30 members on this board have ties to corporations that have received over $76 billion in contracting money over the last 2 years since the Bush administration has come to power, as it were. And just to put that into context, the Department of Defense has doled out over $315 billion of contracts to U.S. corporations in the last 2 years. There's actually been a 20% increase over 2001 in 2002. Now, nothing else in the economy received a 20% increase to the extent the defense contracts did. But nine people on this defense policy board were on the boards of companies that received 25% of the money, or $76 billion, that the Department of Defense doled out, which is a kind of direct transfer from taxpayers directly to the coffers of these companies. So just to put the background into perspective of some of the people on this board.
I'm not terribly surprised that there are these intimate connections, but the Richard Pearl, of course, attracted a lot of headlines a couple of weeks ago. Tell us Pearl's story and his relation to the board.
Pearl a couple of weeks ago was pictured in the New York Times as someone who was both working for a defunct company, Global Crossing, as a consultant. But he was a paid consultant. His fee was $725,000, $600,000 of which would go to him if he managed to convince, among other people, the Department of Defense that Global Crossing should be sold off to the Chinese, a people that Richard Pearl has not historically been very supportive of in general. So it's interesting to know he's getting paid to help sell communications networks to them. But there are other things that Richard Pearl does. As a matter of fact, it's hard to find an area in which there isn't a conflict of interest between something Richard is involved in general. For example, he, very close to the time the Global Crossing story broke, had given a conference call to a group of Goldman Sachs investors, the title of which was Implications of an Imminent War, Iraq Now, North Korea Next. So there he was giving investment advice on what to do after various wars. He's also a partner in a company called Autonomy Corp, in which he holds 120,000 options, as well as some other things that he has been involved in, including a venture capital firm called Trirem Partners, which raises money for military defense companies.
There's also a Bechtel dude on this board, right?
Bechtel is an interesting company. They've certainly profited in the past off of wars, and they have incredibly tight connections to many of the Republican administrations that have come involved recently. Jack Sheehan is a member of Bechtel's company. He joined there from 1998, and he was in the U.S. military as a four-star general for 30 years. Before he joined Bechtel. Bechtel is a private company, so it's very hard to tell how much money anybody is getting paid to work there. They are the sixth largest private company in the United States, very secretive, and top in the running for some of the contracts that are going to come out of this war. They made a few billion bucks off of the last war, and they're certainly in the running for this war.
What sort of contracts? What's their line of business?
They're a construction company, but that means that they rebuild things. They rebuild fields. They rebuild oil fields. They rebuild roads. They rebuild hospitals. They build things. As a matter of fact, very poorly, they have been involved in rebuilding a project called the Big Dig out in Massachusetts, for which they've just been dodging federal audit problems. They're basically trying to make sure that the money that they've been overcharging the state doesn't get public. So that's kind of one of the lines of business that they do. Jack Sheehan actually is the person who runs their international strategy area, which actually includes covering places like the Middle East, Africa, and Europe.
Well, this is kind of interesting because these guys all collectively advise the Defense Department and policy. At the same time, they get insider views of what the Defense Department is planning, and all of these relationships are very convenient to their corporate ties. So, if you're a small guy doing this, it would be called insider trading, but if you're a big guy, it's policy making at the high end.
Absolutely. And not only that, Bechtel and some of the other companies in the running for contracts are on something called the Export Policy Council, which is a Bush-appointed council that discusses matters of international trade. So the CEO of Bechtel is on that council as well, a council that includes the CEO of Boeing, of ExxonMobil, of Comcast, of Goldman Sachs.
Well, free enterprise is a beautiful thing, isn't it? All right, I've been talking with Nomi Prinz, who is a former investment banker who is now a turned journalist investigating the workings of American capitalism, which, as I think Paul O'Neill said, former Treasury Secretary, is a beautiful thing. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. We'll stay tuned for the news. And if all goes well, I should have a rather special guest next week, the internationally renowned cultural theorist and political philosopher Slavoj Žižek, which a little change of pace for this program, but he's in town this weekend, and I'm going to nab him for an interview. So let's go out with this little bit from Cat Power, who a song called Rockets, which is available online at protest-records.com. You can download an MP3, protest-records.com. Played a bunch of stuff from them last week, and this is also a song that you can get in MP3 form at protest-records.com. Okay, till next week, goodbye.